From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio. And here are the issues, or perhaps I should say, the issue. In an historic referendum, Great Britain voted to leave the European Union after 43 years. Prime Minister David Cameron, who favored remaining in the European Union, said he will resign. Well, David Rennie, why did the vote go this way? My expectation, and I followed this pretty closely, was that the people who wanted to pull out, they really made a huge effort, but it fell a little short. There was a relief rally in the American stock market the day before the vote, and it was a pretty substantial vote, 4 percentage points.
Yeah. So, I mean, in one way, it's easier if you have a kind of a map of the British Isles in your head. Basically, what happened was there was some clear divisions. Older people voted overwhelmingly to leave. Younger people voted overwhelmingly to stay. England, middle England, the kind of everywhere except London and the most affluent sort of university towns, kind of small town England, rural England, provincial England, suburban England, voted strongly to leave. Scotland voted pretty strongly to stay. But here's the problem. Why is this the latest election or referendum where the polls have not got it right? It was about turnout. So basically, there seems to be much more enthusiasm, passion, and excitement on the leave side. So the kind of towns, often kind of ex-industrial, working class, very sort of disadvantaged, unhappy, angry towns, voted to leave with very high turnout, kind of in the high 70s. And the kind of places full of Remain voters, kind of college towns, London, they underperformed on turnout. So basically, it turned out to be more exciting to vote leave than to vote stay, and that got you a pretty hefty mandate.
I have one small question. You mentioned Scotland. I think Northern Ireland voted to stay, but Wales voted to go. Have I got that right?
You have. So normally we think of a kind of Celtic fringe of Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland voting in the same way, but there's a lot of cross currents in this. So Wales is also, among other things, it was a one-party state completely controlled by the Labour Party. You had all these kind of working-class, socialist, trade union, labour union, kind of coal miners and steel workers. They were, like everyone who voted to leave, voting a sort of punch the establishment in the face kind of vote. If you're in Wales, the establishment that you wanted to punch in the face was the Labour Party, and Labour was, you know, saying to vote yes. So it was kind of an anti-globalisation, stop the world, we want to get off vote. Why is that different in Scotland? Because Scotland has plenty of angry people who want to kind of punch the elites in the face. Part of it is there's a sort of Scotland reacting against the English kind of phenomenon. That this was seen as kind of an explosion of English nationalism. The vocal leaders of the Leave campaign were, on the whole, sort of posh-sounding Englishmen. That didn't sound like a kind of very Scottish campaign. And I strongly opposed the idea that there was any sense in a Scottish independence vote when they had a referendum last year. This morning, though it breaks my heart as an English Scot to imagine Britain breaking up, when the Scottish First Minister, the leader of the pro-independence party, Nicola Sturgeon, said, democratically, we voted to stay in the EU, so we need to think about having another referendum on independence, it's hard to fault her logic.
Well, that seemed to be her first reaction. I've got, Michael, I haven't forgotten you, but I want to ask, I want to ask him one other question. How big was the immigration issue? It seemed like a huge one.
So if you listen to the elite kind of conservative politicians and commentators who are campaigning to leave the European Union, they are saying this morning, oh, this was a kind of fantastic, open-minded, pro-global, tolerant, multicultural vote for a kind of libertarian, less regulated, less highly taxed, kind of glorious Britain. That's just not how they won. They won because there were other members of the Leave campaign, particularly a party, the UK Independence Party, led by Nigel Farage, and they just pumped out an absolute diet of, we need to take control of our borders back. They said absolute untruths, which was that Turkey, a Muslim country of 76 million people, was about to join the European Union. Absolutely not true. And we've had a kind of post-truth referendum. We're into post-truth politics, very similar to the things we see here with Donald Trump. So take that point of Turkey. People like The Economist, my magazine, we would say, hang on, actually, Britain gets a veto on Turkish accession. Turkey isn't going to be a member anytime soon. If Britain does want Turkey to join, Britain can stop Turkey joining. What happens? They just carried on pumping out the leaflets and the posters saying Turkey is about to join. Yesterday's front page of the Daily Mail had on its front page a completely untrue, made-up story about secret talks to let Turkey join the European Union due to begin 3 days after the referendum. Just totally untrue. These were routine talks, nothing to do with, you know, a secret conspiracy, but, you know, lies and an anti-immigration push swept them over the line.
David, you just have to realize how the media works. Any meeting in which reporters and columnists are not there is automatically a secret meeting. So I'm being a little facetious here, but not entirely. Michael, what is your take on this? And, you know, I heard one of the commentators right after the vote say the difference was, and I think David has touched on this too, between the voters who were voting emotionally, and particularly on the immigration issue, against voters who were voting economically, because the argument of the Remain people was basically this is good, it'll be bad economically. If Britain leaves, it'll be good if we stay.
There was a lot of emotion in this whole thing, and I think that the overriding emotion that won the day is fear. Fear of the other, fear of a world where people see themselves being less and less in control of their future and of their lives than they have been in the past. This whole idea of globalization and other markets being able to intrude and dictate what happens in your own backyard. Again, this vote, you can't minimize the importance of this and what it does. Are we looking at not only the dissolution, as you say, of possibly of the entire European Union, but possibly the dissolution of the United Kingdom? So Scotland wants to be in the EU. Now, whether that was a gesture at the English, who knows? But I think other referendums are going to come. Other referenda are going to come from the continent. And it's just such a period of uncertainty now. And it's going to be a long period because this isn't sort of like we vote to go and now we leave. It's going to take years to unwind all of the trade agreements, the military agreements, the political agreements that go along with being in the European Union. And each one of those has to be approved by the members of the union. So there's just a lot to see from this point on.
Do you think David Cameron, the Prime Minister, made a mistake in calling for this referendum? He did it, you know, he agreed, he'd been under pressure from a lot of members of his Conservative Party, and he, to sort of alleviate that pressure, when a couple of years ago, I think, when was it?
2013.
Yeah, 2013.
But the die had been cast a little bit earlier than that.
But anyway, he agreed to it, and you know, I think in the U.S., when you, about a referendum, you know, when the owners of a football team want to build a new stadium and have the public pay for it, they usually don't have a referendum because they fear it might lose.
Yeah, I think, you know, hindsight is 20/20, of course. I think, you know, very few people saw this result coming. You never know what you're going to get now when you go to the people. You have to be very, very careful when you ask a populace that is angry, that is disaffected, that knows that it wants something different but doesn't know exactly what that different thing is or quite understand how to get to what their desires are. I think David said earlier that the British people just voted for something that really can't be delivered by their politicians and by the policies. And I think that's a very astute comment. How do you really get to what these people just voted for? Independence is one thing. Success and progress and prosperity are quite another. And independence from the European Union guarantees none of those things.
Yep. What about politically in England? Cameron's going to resign this summer, I believe, or maybe
before October.
Yeah. What happens to the Conservative Party and the I look at the practically moribund Labour Party. Is there any chance it can revive?
Well, the Labour Party, we've just had a headline that there's a leadership challenge there too. So this is, I think, the first time in British political history that we've had the two largest parties having a leadership challenge at the same time. So we could lose both leaders. Essentially, and there are echoes of this in lots of rich Western democracies, including America, where we're sitting, the big political parties are discovering that they are a bad fit with their voters and that the program that they were offering is being rejected by their voters. In part, I think that politicians have themselves to blame. I think you're absolutely right, Fred, to ask whether David Cameron brought this on himself. He did, in a sense. He promised this referendum before the last general election, essentially because his MPs were getting very jumpy. They were hearing on the doorstep that people were in a very anti-European mood. He was worried about losing votes to the right to this anti-Europe party, UKIP. And so he thought this was a clever gambit. If he promised a referendum, that sort of saw off that threat. But the problem was he then had to have the referendum. But Michael's also right. I think the tragedy here is that the British people have delivered an unambiguous mandate for continued free trade and prosperity involving selling lots and lots of stuff to Europe and an end to open borders when it comes to the free movement of people with Europe. So they want both those things, and they have been told they can have both those things. And we at The Economist, among others, tried our best to say, you know what, you are going to be made to choose. You cannot have that kind of a la carte Europe where you get to have the total right to build a car in the UK under loose UK, looser environmental rules than apply in Europe, looser labour laws than apply in Europe, so you can make the car cheaply, then sell it into Europe with no trade barriers at all, and then ban other European citizens from moving to the UK to seek jobs. I don't see how other European governments can possibly give us that kind of deal when their own electorates won't let them.
I remember sitting here many months ago and talking to you about this, about the calculation of the Prime Minister. And his calculation was that he could negotiate with the EU officials and get enough compromises or concessions or something that that would allow him to say, look, look what I've got. We don't need to withdraw. And you said, well, the EU officials are not going to give him much. And they didn't. Should they have?
I don't think they could give him what he wanted, because one of the problems is I think we're in a world of politicians thinking that they can head off populist rage in the electorate by offering people a little bit of a bad idea. And I think that's really dangerous politics. You know, so David Cameron, one of the reasons that he lost this referendum is instead of defending freedom of movement within the European Union, which is what we, the economists, would like him to have done, we would like him to say it is nonsense to say that British hospitals and schools are being destroyed by hardworking, taxpaying Poles moving into the UK. They are young, they're healthy, they have kids, they've chosen to pay their taxes in the UK, they contribute far more to the British government coffers than they take out, and their taxes help pay for building new hospitals. A quarter of the staff in those new hospitals, by the way, are EU migrants from other European countries. So you could have made that pitch, but because David Cameron had tried to feed the beast, he tried feeding little bits of red meat to the anti-immigrant right, he had ceded the point that immigration is basically a very bad thing at all times, and he would try and limit it as much as possible. He made this ridiculous pledge before the last election that he would bring down net immigration into the UK to the tens of thousands a year, down from hundreds of thousands a year. He couldn't possibly deliver that. And what that meant was he couldn't defend the European project's core thing, which is open borders. And so, you know, he was left utterly unable to defend the thing he was trying to save.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Michael Williams of CBS Radio and David Raney of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/archive/issuesinthenews. All right, Michael, I'm going to get back to you here. What about, we saw it popped up all over Europe, other populist leaders, so-called, in other countries said, well, we want a referendum too. France, Sweden, and
the Netherlands, Austria, congratulating us.
All over. Yeah. And how strong do we think that is? I think it will be a very strong effort. I don't know what France would get out of withdrawing from the EU, but anyway, there is a strong feeling.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you go to the website you just mentioned and go to the archives, you'll hear that in the beginning of the year show that we did, we talked about the fact that this huge push of Syrian immigration was going to be a lever that could possibly wedge out one or many members from the European Union, that it was that strong of an issue. The numbers were sufficient to do that. And I think this is exactly what's happened. This is the issue. It's the open borders, as David said. And it's not just the open borders, because it's okay when you have Europeans going to other European countries. I think that the culture of Europe supported that. But when you have this Turkish border in Syria beyond, you have millions of refugees coming in, you have the fear of terrorism, radical Islamic terrorism, if you want to call it that, you have a situation where everybody is going to want to try to protect themselves. And I think even falsely, what people are going to be telling, these nationalist leaders are going to be telling their populaces is that the exact same thing that was fed to the UK, that we can have it all. We can have closed borders. Mm-hmm. We can have economic success. We can get sort of this piecemeal thing that's perfect. Well, you just can't. Each country, none of them are going to accept that. But the nationalist bent that's going on right now, I think it's virulent. I think it's dangerous. It could potentially turn extremely violent. We have to watch that. And it's, again, going to come to our own shores. We're going to see more and more of that as we move to the general election. And Donald Trump sort of fans the flames here.
Why is it virulent and dangerous when people want to tighten their borders? You couldn't actually close them entirely, I don't think. Could you, David? Wait a minute. Let Michael answer it. What's wrong with that impulse that people feel that? They want to, you know, and people say, you know, we want our country back. You've heard the cliches, and we want to protect our country and so on.
And it depends on what you want back, what you think you're getting back is maybe some sort of control, maybe some sort of going back to the past, if you will, a feeling that, you know, this country was better when. Well, when was it better? And what did it look like then? Well, it looked better and I made more money before those people got here. I think that there's just a misperception and a miscalculation of people that it's very easily manipulated, that you can use certain people as a scapegoat for the things that are happening in your own life, in your own economy, in your own politics. So I think that's the danger of it. Certainly you want to have control of your borders. Certainly you want to control immigration. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But scapegoating immigration blindly when immigration, as David rightly points out, is so responsible for the growth and progress in so many nations is just foolhardy.
I think there's also, you know, sure, it's a legitimate impulse for people to worry about security. It's a legitimate impulse for people to worry about, you know, we can't let every foreigner in the world move into the country. That's fine. But there's two problems with that. One is there's a cost to closing yourself off. I mean, I've been to North Korea twice as a journalist. There's a country that very few people try and get into. You know, very few people try and illegally immigrate into North Korea. And it has really tight borders. But, you know, that comes at a price. There's a reason people don't want to live in North Korea if they're born outside.
That's a pretty remote comparison, however.
The point is, you know, absolute sovereignty. If you keep saying that your absolute principle is sovereignty and having secure borders, you know, you can have sovereignty and secure borders. But it is also quite a good idea to try and build the kind of prosperous country that people do actually want to move into. I think the other thing that shows you how strange this political moment is Britain hasn't taken a large number of Syrian refugees. Britain isn't part of the borderless Schengen zone in Europe. There are frontier controls. There's the English Channel. There's actually strict controls. The number of Syrians that Britain has taken in is, you know, a couple of tens of thousands, I think, compared to a million into Germany. If you offered most continental governments, Germany's or Italy's or Greece's, the deal that Britain has now, not being part of the Schengen area, having only tens of thousands of Syrian migrants, no chance of those millions turning up in Britain anytime soon because there are border controls. If you said you could have that, that would be beyond their wildest dreams. But here's the remarkable thing about the politics we're in, that Britain, which has easily the most secure border regime of any country in the European Union, British public were convinced they had the loosest because it was about emotion and kind of gut instinct. And final thing, sorry, I should be brief, is I think if you want a single phrase that sums up what we've just been through, it was when a British government minister, who was in fact previously the education secretary, said during a debate when someone mentioned that the IMF and the Bank of England and various people had warned against the economic consequences, he said, "This country has had enough of experts." And I think that that was both an unbelievably cynical thing for someone like him to say.
I understand that impulse.
But it's also, it's a really dangerous impulse because if you're saying, you know, I'm going to get in that plane, I don't care what the you know, what the pilot says. You know, at a certain point, we, you know, experts have had a bad run for sure. But if you just decide that because an expert is saying something, you should ignore it, that's a very dangerous political road to go down.
What about, Michael, how will this affect the United States? We'll talk about the short run. We don't know about the long run.
We're still waiting to hear some of our current leaders express their opinions about it. I've heard Paul Ryan's statement where he said this will not affect the special relationship that exists with the UK. And I think that's true. The special relationship.
I was thinking more economically.
Will definitely remain. Yeah. And I'm going to go on to say that economically, I do think that certainly the ripple has been felt already with the currency falling. You have gold rising. You have all kinds of things that happen immediately. Over the long run, look, the UK now has to establish all new trade agreements. And so all of this is going to be just a very complicated piecework type of thing. It's a lot of make work now, you know, to maintain that economic relationship.
I know the Italian prime minister said he was calling for retribution against Great Britain, but to me, that doesn't make much sense. Wouldn't forging new economic and trade relationships with Great Britain be in the EU, the best interest of EU countries?
And it just depends on what you put together. Now, the mechanism for doing that. Do you invoke Article 50, which says you now have 2 years to get this done? Or do you sort of do this sort of informally? Mm-hmm. Do you become part of the European Economic Area, I believe it's called? Mm-hmm. And I think like Norway is it, where you have sort of this loose agreement where you have...
You're an associate member.
An associate member. Yeah. But you do still, you have economic status, but you also have to have free borders. So there's really, as you said, we said many times over the course of this conversation, there's really no free lunch for this thing. And that's what the electorate is voting for.
Well, and here's the problem. So just briefly on the effects on the US. So in the very short term, I don't think anyone in the US, certainly not people running the US in the government right now, thinks that this is a great moment for major market meltdowns around the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, the US recovery is very fragile. Mm-hmm. The US has been one of the bright spots around the major economies. Mm-hmm. They do not want markets falling in panic around the world. So that's the very short term. Don't let's forget that although Britain is not, you know, the most enormous country in the world, it is very close economically as well as politically to the US, and in many recent years has been the single largest source of foreign direct investment into the US. There's a stock of about $500 billion of British investments in the US. Mm-hmm. There's about 800,000 people employed directly in America by British companies. There's gigantic American investments in the UK, some of the largest American businesses. Mm-hmm. The UK is their manufacturing hub for a lot of Europe. And all of that is now thrown into disarray. And you make the point, Fred, that people on the British Eurosceptic Brexit side said, which is, why would the Europeans cut their noses off to spite their faces? Why would they do a bad trade deal when they want to sell German cars to British motorists?
Yeah, well put.
Things?
That's exactly my question.
So here's the answer to that. If Britain was offering to trade freely with the European Union in both directions whilst obeying all of the expensive regulations that Europe has imposed on itself, and while letting Europeans have, you know, equal right to seek contracts in the UK, that'd be one thing. But to get crunchy, let's imagine, take a town like Sunderland in the north of England, which voted massively to leave. The single biggest employer there is a Nissan car factory. Mm-hmm. Now, at the moment, those Nissan cars that it produces can be sold freely in the rest of Europe. One reason is they obey all the European environmental rules. Mm-hmm. They obey all the European emissions rules. The workers have to obey European labour law. Now imagine that in the new Britain, they say, let's slash all the environmental rules, have dirtier engines, have looser... Because that's exactly what the right has been promising.
I know, but
they
what
say
if
we'll sweep away those environmental regulations
what if they don't
and those
do
labour
that?
Laws.
I mean, it's more likely that they won't do that.
In which case, what have they achieved? Because if we achieve something like Norway, where we have to obey all of the European regulations, but without getting a say to set them, then yeah, we probably could continue to have free trade on the current basis.
I want to touch on one other thing that was talked about, and I'll start with you, Michael, and I'm sure David will have something to say about this as well, and that is this notion of a English-speaking trade union. I'm not sure who brought that up, but anyway, it has, you know, England, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, I guess the U.S. Could be part of that. What about that? It seems a little far-fetched to me.
It seems a little far-fetched to me, too, to be quite honest. Honestly, it sounds like there's a cultural homogenization that's there. You know, we want to
probably because it is there
with our own. Yeah. I just feel, again, it just goes back to a sense of fear of the other, wanting to pull out and wanting to sort of tribalize, you know, the world in this way. Look, I think anything is possible. Certainly this is something that can be talked about, but again, the UK was in this union for 43 years. Mm-hmm. 43 years. To put together something that's really workable, feasible, and useful is going to be tough to do. Unwinding this and sort of integrating that with all the other mechanisms and associations that exist in the world.
David, where did that idea come from?
Well, let's talk the Anglosphere. Yeah, well, you have romantics on the right of the Conservative Party in Britain who have their friends in Washington, the Republican Party, and it's been floating around forever that actually we're much closer to the Anglo-Saxon kind of free market, Magna Carta, common law, you know, hooray, hooray. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the test, though. I mean, Fred, you know people like Senator McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, pretty well. Mm-hmm. I bet if I went to Senator McConnell next week and said, Majority Leader McConnell, imagine you're still in control of the Senate after the next election, and the first thing I want to put on your agenda is a free trade pact with Britain. Do you think that the easiest thing to get through the next Congress, starting off, is going to be a foreign-free trade pact in which Britain's going to want some concessions because you're soggily sentimental about the Magna Carta?
Yeah, right. A point well made.
How's that going to go?
Nowhere. Nowhere, that's for sure. That's all the time we have today. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Wagner Roberts and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.